It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Israeli airstrikes resume after Hamas militants reject a ceasefire, and Iraqi Kurds have new reason for optimism about a future Kurdish state. I'm Terry Wing in Washington. Israel continued airstrikes today in the Gaza Strip a day after accepting a ceasefire plan and pausing its campaign, only to resume when the militant group Hamas rejected the pact. The airstrikes early today killed at least 3 people in the Palestinian territory. About 200 people have been killed in Gaza since the Israeli military began an operation to end Hamas rocket attacks last week. One Israeli has died. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said he was due to travel to Egypt today to meet with President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to discuss how to successfully implement the ceasefire proposal. Iraq's fractious parliament moved a step closer on Tuesday to resolving its political stalemate by naming Sunni lawmaker Salim al-Jaburi as speaker. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden telephoned his congratulations to Jaburi. The White House says Biden and Jaburi agreed that Iraqi lawmakers must move quickly to form a new government and tackle the insurgency by Sunni militants. Last week, Kurdish fighters seized important oil facilities after Iraqi forces abandoned them under the advance by the Sunni militants. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the Kurds view their new acquisition as a major step toward an independent Kurdistan.
An estimated 4% of known global oil reserves lie beneath these sands in Kirkuk. It is a prize that Iraq's Kurds have long sought to control. The KRG says it hopes to export 400,000 barrels of oil per day by 2015. Energy consultant Valerie Marcel of the Policy Institute Chatham House.
The opening of the pipeline from Kurdistan to Turkey is really groundbreaking because it really does enable Kurdistan to turn away from Baghdad, to turn away from the Middle East proper and towards Turkey and Europe. And that opens all sorts of doors.
Amid the turmoil in Iraq, the Kurds sense an opportunity. Its rulers see the oil fields of Kirkuk as the economic foundation of a future Kurdish state. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry ended 3 dates of talks in Vienna Tuesday with his Iranian counterpart, failing to break the deadlock over the future of Iran's nuclear program. But lower-level talks will continue at least until a Sunday deadline to reach a long-term agreement. The Vienna talks and whether there will be an extension of the deadline came up at Tuesday's State Department briefing. Here's spokesperson Jennifer Psaki.
The team in Vienna will continue to meet. Progress has been made and the process continues. The secretary is going to be consulting with the president and with Congress in the coming days. And certainly an extension will be an option that's discussed. But I'll leave it to the team on the ground to provide any updates.
Diplomats from Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia, and the United States have been working with Iran on a long-term nuclear deal. Afghan authorities say a suicide blast has killed at least 41 people in the eastern Afghanistan province of Patika. Defense Ministry spokesperson General Mohammad Zahir Azimi had earlier said that 89 people were killed, but the death toll was lowered by the provincial governor and President Hamid Karzai's office. Meantime, President Karzai says he's reluctantly accepting a U.S. mediated deal to audit all the votes from the country's presidential runoff election following allegations of fraud during the voting process. VOA's Aru Pandey has more.
In an exclusive interview with VOA's Afghan service, President Karzai said he did not welcome the agreement, but accepted it as a bitter pill due to the current political conditions in Afghanistan.
I accepted it because I wanted to get past the stage very quickly, because the elections have already taken a lot of time in this country. No country in the world has such a lengthy electoral process. And this must be corrected as well.
Tensions were high in the country after presidential candidates Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani both claimed victory in the June 14th runoff to replace Mr. Karzai. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
You can get the latest world news whenever you want it at voanews.com. I'm Terry Wing in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's government and armed groups begin peace talks today in Algeria.
The fact that the parties, government and armed movements, are assembled to have these talks, we want to suppose that there is trust, there is commitment, there is willingness.
Isaka Suarez is the special advisor to the head of the African Union mission in Mali. French President Francois Hollande begins a three-nation Africa visit tomorrow, Thursday. The international SOS says it receives quadruple requests for information about Ebola in West Africa in the month of June. And the families of the kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls refused to meet with President Goodluck Jonathan.
My priority and responsibility and duty is the return, the safe return of these girls. Unfortunately, political forces within the Nigerian chapter of Bring Back Our Girls have decided to play politics with the situation.
Doyin Okupe is the public affairs assistant to President Jonathan. Employers in South Africa's latest strike threatened to withdraw their offer for wage increase, and some South Sudanese are not sure whether to stay in their country or to leave amid a seven-month-old civil war. Those stories plus Mark Owoman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union mission to Mali and the Sahel has called on Mali's government and representatives of armed groups to ensure transparency and goodwill as the parties begin peace negotiations in neighboring Algeria today, Wednesday. Isaka Suare is the special advisor to the head of the AU mission and former Burundian President Pierre Buyoya. Suare tells reporter Peter Clotty the African Union is committed to ensuring a compromise so as to restore peace and stability in Mali.
One of the objectives of the African Union mission for Mali and the Sahel, which is led by former President Pierre Buyoya of Burundi, is to assist the Malian authorities and the parties to get to these inclusive talks, which we hope will lead to a greater amelioration of the security situation, but also a definitive resolution of the conflict, including the military aspect in terms of the demobilization and reintegration in whatever way the Malians would agree of former combatants of armed movement.
Now, what do you think are the prospects of the talks, especially when there have been recent skirmishes, some armed groups attacking unarmed civilians, scores dead or injured? There seem to be some quite a little bit of rumbling up north.
The essence of the talks really to put an end to these skirmishes. So the fact that the parties, government and armed movements, are assembled to have these talks, we want to suppose that there is trust, there is commitment, there is willingness. And so long as you have these conditions met, the prospects of they reaching an agreement are great. And the African Union, in conjunction with other regional ECOWAS, that is international, UN, the European Union, others, in conjunction with these actors, will do everything it can to ensure that we reach a conclusive agreement at the end of this process.
Will the AU be at the table when these two parties or these parties meet in Algeria during the talks?
That is the idea. The idea is to have an open, transparent process in which not only you have one lead facilitator, that could be the Algerian authorities, but which would be supported by international actors such as the AU, the ECOWAS, and the European Union. Because those that are representing these organizations on the ground or at their headquarters have a wealth of expertise and experience, bringing which to the table can only enrich the process and help the lead facilitator to reach this conclusive agreement that we are all looking for.
Isaka Suare is the special advisor to the head of the African Union mission in Mali. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Mali's capital, Bamako. French President François Hollande flies to Africa tomorrow, Thursday, on a three-nation visit that will focus on economic issues and rooting out terrorism in the Sahel region. Lisa Bryant has more on the trip from Paris.
Security tops the agenda of President François Hollande's trip to Africa, where he'll visit French troops and hold talks with leaders of Niger, Chad, and Ivory Coast. France has just announced a new mission to fight jihadists in the Sahel area. The operation is called Barkhane, named after a type of sand dune. Alain Onti heads a sub-Saharan African program for the French Institute for International Relations in Paris.
La mission Barkhane va donner un peu de cohérence à la présence de troupes françaises qui sont déjà présentes.
Onti notes that Barkhane makes use of French troops already in Mauritania, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. He says the new operation will give coherence to the French military presence in the Sahel and to the regional fight against terrorism. Roughly 3,000 French military personnel will be involved, including about 1,200 troops who took part in the offensive against Islamists in northern Mali. On Monday, a French soldier was killed in a suicide attack near the city of Gao, underscoring the security concerns.
Les soldats français présents au Niger et l'armée nigérienne.
Analyst Antil says regional countries like Niger cooperate closely with France in security matters, but he says it's important for other players, including European countries, to be more involved. In Ivory Coast, Mr. Hollande will focus on trade and investment issues in a country whose economy has rebounded after a long civil war. In Chad, Mr. Hollande's last stop and where the Sahel operation will be based, human rights activists fear rights issues might take a back seat to security matters.
C'est-à-dire que les différents présidents, ils arrivent avec des bonnes idées.
Antil predicts Mr. Hollande will pay lip service to human rights. The socialist president promised a new relationship with Africa when he was elected. But Antil says that, like other French leaders, he's become more pragmatic in office. For African countries, even Francophone ones, France's star is fading in favor of new players like China and India. But Mr. Hollande, who launched missions in Mali and the Central African Republic, has earned respect and even popularity in some parts of the continent, the kind of support that eludes him back home in France. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The medical and travel security group known as International SOS says the number of requests it received for advice on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa was up by 400% in the month of June. The World Health Organization announced on Tuesday that the number of Ebola cases rose to 964, including 603 deaths. Dr. Robert Quigley, Vice President for Medical Assistance at the International SOS, says 56% of the requests were generated in Guinea, while 17% came from Liberia and 16% from Sierra Leone. He tells me his organization gives advice to over 100 client organizations with physicians working in areas where Ebola cases have been confirmed, and to business travelers and expatriates.
Since the initial outbreak, which was sometime in March of this year in several countries in Africa, we've had a 400% increase, predominantly just in the last 2 months. And these calls that are coming in are calls from business travelers, organizations, individuals on the ground that are requesting information of people who have a vested interest in the disease and the epidemiology associated therewith.
What is the nature of the inquiries they are making?
Well, I think that the media, as you well know, has kept very much aware of what's going on, and there seem to be a number of waves of outbreaks, and every time there's a new wave, there's a new amount of information available in social media and in the news, and consequently there's more and more exposure to these business travelers who are having concerns, and appropriately so. And any of these travelers that happen to subscribe to our business at International SOS will call us, as they are entitled to do so, and get information from subject matter experts.
You say that approximately about, 56% of the requests were generated in Guinea?
That is correct. And then, but outside of those regions, there's been a significant number of or an uptick in calls coming through the United Kingdom, and that's probably because I always think of the UK as sort of a central hub of business travel, and so they're rightly so concerned about this disease, which has no cure and there's no vaccination, and they want to make sure that they're doing everything they can in the spirit of duty of care to mitigate the risks to their employees, and I respect that.
Do you sometimes find maybe some misconceptions in these inquiries? Because the other day, I have a college-age son, and he was watching a video online. And when he got through, he came to me and he asked me if I had eaten bush meat before. And I said, yes. So he said, oh, he just watched the video about Ebola, and if you eat bush meat, then you're likely to attract Ebola.
Bless his heart for paying attention to such a video. No doubt the bushmeat can serve as a source of the disease, and as you know, bushmeat is ubiquitous in certain parts of Africa and considered even a staple in many of the diets, particularly of the local folks. And unfortunately, the harsh reality is that this disease can be transmitted through bushmeat, and so we are following the guidelines of both WHO and CDC and advising any of our business travelers not to be consuming bushmeat just because that does increase the risks of transmission of the disease.
Dr. Robert Quigley is Vice President for Medical Assistance at the International SOS. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Philadelphia. It is Wednesday morning, July 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The Nigerian government says families of the more than 200 kidnapped schoolgirls have refused to meet with President Goodluck Jonathan, allegedly at the request of the activist group Bring Back Our Girls. As Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from Abuja, the incident throws the kidnapped girls into the center of national politics, which are heating up before elections next year.
On Monday, President Goodluck Jonathan promised the Pakistani girls' education activist, Malala Yousafzai, that he would meet with the families of the girls held captive by Boko Haram militants for the past 3 months. The meeting was scheduled for Tuesday in Abuja, but the families canceled. Doyen Akupe, a public affairs assistant to the president, says the families refused to attend the meeting at the last minute and blames Bring Back Our Girls, an activist group that rallies almost every day to demand the girls' rescue. This is Akupe reading a statement from Mr. Jonathan.
My priority and responsibility and duty is the return, the safe return of these girls. Unfortunately, political forces within the Nigerian chapter of Bring Back Our Girls have decided to take this opportunity to play politics with the situation and the grief of the parents and these girls.
Akupe accuses Bring Back Our Girls of being in league with opposition politicians, seeking to unseat Mr. Jonathan in elections next year.
What are we asking?
Outside the hotel grounds, the Bring Back Our Girls rally is smaller than usual, as about 20 activists chant and hear speeches in the rain. Activist Mia Muna says the families of the Chibok girls canceled the meeting on their own. She says the families were insulted that Malala had to ask the president to see them, rather than him offering on his own. And partially, she says, they canceled for security reasons.
We don't even need to tell them not to come, not to go. They themselves refuse to go because they fear that if they are shown on TV all the time, this Boko Haram will still come after them. That was the fear.
After the rally, Jeff Okorofor, the founder of Opinion Nigeria, an activist group that is part of the Bring Back Our Girls network, says the parents wanted to see the president, but felt it was wrong to visit him in the capital when he has not visited them in their home village, Chibok. He blames the government for trying to distract the public from the real issue, the missing girls, by going after Bring Back Our Girls.
The government for a very long time have been coming up with a lot of excuses. The government for a very long time have been coming up with a lot of distractions for the group. But the world can testify to what we are doing. We are open, and that's why we are in an open space. Our conduct has been very civil.
The government accuses the Bring Back Our Girls campaign of playing shameful and disgusting games and repeated its promise to find the girls and end the Boko Haram insurgency. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
In South Africa, a group representing the steel and engineering industry said it is withdrawing its latest wage offer to end a two-week-old strike by members of the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, known as NUMSA, the country's largest labor union. The employers had offered the workers a 10% wage increase for this year, followed by an increase of 9.5% next year and 9% in 2016. The workers have been demanding a 12% wage increase. Vuyo Lufele, Secretary General for NUMSA in Western Cape Province, tells me the workers will not accept any increase less than 10% for all 3 years.
From our side, we were still engaging with employers, and our members were not happy with the offer of 10% that would be followed by 9.5% and 9%. They wanted 10%, but also 10% for next year and 10% for the other year. In fact, nothing less than a double digit. That's what our members were demanding. Therefore, we were prepared to engage with the employers. But with the employers' attitude that they want to amend Section 37, our members said, in whatever is happening, we should not allow the amendment to Section 37.
What's next?
Now, there is mediation that is going to take place, facilitated by the Metal Engineering Industry Bargaining Council, which would take place from Thursday, the 17th. There would be a facilitated process, which would begin with employers. And on Friday, the 18th, the facilitator would be sitting with the trade union leadership. And then on the 21st, which is Monday, then there will be a plenary session where the facilitator would then try to bring the two parties together on what would be the settlement. And we are looking forward to that, which means that by Monday we may get to something new, whether there's a settlement or whatever would come up by Monday.
We are talking about wages, but I know that the union is on strike for other issues besides wages. Is there any progress on those other issues?
There was a progress on a number of issues, although now I can't quote from here. But in terms of what you call a short time, employers agreed that, okay, there must be a short time fund, which would be a contribution of 5 cents from each member and 5 cents from the employer, which means it would be 50-50 contribution, so that when it comes to short time, there can be a payment to our members. And there's a number of issues, training and others. And there were some progress made on a number of issues.
Vuyo Lufele is the Secretary General for NUMSA of Western Cape Province. He was speaking with me from Cape Town. When South Sudan gained independence 3 years ago, millions returned home for the first time to help build their nation. But many quickly learned the challenges were more difficult than anticipated. And with political conflict and violence persistent for the last 7 months, a number of South Sudanese are beginning to doubt their own future and that of the country. Benno Mushla has this report from Juba.
Oh, I am tall, I am dark, I am beautiful, that's what's up. People, please, don't you see? I'm a Southern Sudanese.
Mare Ayang sits in a cafe in Juba, wearing short hair, an orange sundress, and long golden earrings. In 2010, she came to South Sudan to vote for independence. She feels nostalgic about that time.
It was an amazing experience. It was a highlight for many South Sudanese, the referendum time. People came from everywhere to vote for the first time for their country, for independence.
The 28-year-old was raised in Khartoum, Sudan, and studied in South Africa. She came to Juba to help establish the National Archives at the Ministry of Culture. She discovered what she had to offer was not wanted.
I was frustrated of not being able to serve my country to the fullest with the skill that I have, which is a situation that many young men and women are going through. So many skilled people coming from different places. It's either you're corrupt to get your things done, or you have a connection or a relative or something. Nobody cares what you know or what you can do. It's about who you know and how much you have.
Ayang voiced her frustration through music. After gaining some popularity in an East African singing contest on TV, she recorded the single Southern Sudanese about the problem of tribalism. It became a local hit. A future in music seemed possible, But in December, the country's two largest ethnic groups started fighting, killing thousands and displacing 1.5 million people. Ayang says she lost seven cousins and fled with her family to neighboring Uganda for a time. She came back a few months ago, but can't see a future right now.
I am literally currently very somehow numb emotionally. People are trying to do something, but like I'm literally just not doing anything. I want to reflect on the situation and somehow reach a discernment within myself of what I can do and how I can do it effectively.
Thousands of other South Sudanese are facing similar choices. Only time will tell what the majority decides. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Juba.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Kenya's Harambee Stars and Burundi Swallows played to a scoreless draw in Nairobi on Tuesday. The match is a build-up for both teams as they prepare for their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers this coming weekend. In Uganda, the hosts, Uganda Cranes and Malawi, also played to a scoreless draw on Tuesday. Earlier on, Uganda pipped Seychelles 1-0 also in Kampala in another qualifier for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers due this coming weekend. Meanwhile, the local organizing committee chairman for the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia, Alexei Sorokin, reckons that they will not only match but actually surpass the quality of organization of football greatest spectacle in 4 years. Sorokin made these revelations in Rio de Janeiro at the end of the just concluded 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Turning to swimming, Zimbabwe's most accomplished Olympian, Kirsty Coventry, has moved to Charlotte, North Carolina in the United States of America to begin her training for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. She says she'll miss her family and friends. However, after getting married, she says she has settled well in her new training camp and hopes to do Zimbabwe proud at the next Olympic Games. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Wednesday morning comes from Ali Osano of Juba, South Sudan. He says, dear VOA, it's been 3 consecutive months since Boko Haram insurgents kidnapped over 275 schoolgirls in northern Nigeria. Boko Haram of Nigeria, Al-Shabaab of Somalia, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, ISIS of Syria and Iraq, all have one thing in common, that is killing. Therefore, I urge with world leaders and all responsible governments to make sure these groups are defeated. We thank you, Ali Osano of Juba, South Sudan, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. That's it for this Wednesday, July 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone a very good Wednesday.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante AU, African Youth, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing.
So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.